Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2007, executives at Purdue Pharma, makers of the powerful painkiller OxyContin, pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges that they'd misbranded the powerful opioid and misrepresented its potential for abuse and addiction. Purdue paid a $634 million fine in that settlement, and it was heralded as a major victory by the federal government at the time. But a stunning recent report from the New York Times shows that prosecutors had gathered a mountain of evidence that Purdue Pharma execs knew about significant abuse of OxyContin in the first years after the drug was approved by the FDA. And prosecutors wanted to go further, according to the Times reporting. They wanted to charge top Purdue Pharma executives with felonies, including conspiracy to defraud the United States, that could have sent the executives to prison if they were convicted. But those efforts came to a grinding halt after Purdue's legal team held a previously unknown meeting with political appointees in the Justice Department, after which the government backed down. Barry Meyer reported the story for the New York Times. It also appears in his book, Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic. The book's second edition just came out late last month, and Barry Meyer joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Barry.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm happy to be here.
This is a stunning story, and I wonder if we just might treat it simply here and kind of chronologically and march through time a little bit. Can you just start at the beginning? Just remind us briefly, when OxyContin was approved by the FDA in, 1995, 96, by what was the basis of its approval?
So basically, the story goes like this. In late 1995, the FDA approves OxyContin, and it gives it a unique – it allows Purdue Pharma to make a unique labeling claim for it. Essentially, it allows Purdue to say that OxyContin, because it's a long-acting form of oxycodone, a narcotic, is less – it's believed that it's less likely to be abused or cause addiction than traditional painkillers, mm-hmm. drugs like Percocet or Vicodin.
Right.
So the FDA has never given a pharmaceutical company the ability to make this claim before. And Purdue Pharma, a very small company in Connecticut, takes this claim and starts running with it.
Well, in fact, as you report, they say that the FDA's decision is so valuable, it could be OxyContin's principal selling tool.
And it becomes that. It becomes the basic foundation for what is the largest advertising promotional campaign for a prescription narcotic in the history of the drug industry. They shower millions of dollars on doctors. They hire speakers. They do promotional events. They do junkets. And they turn it into a billion-dollar blockbuster drug.
Right.
They have doctors throughout America prescribing OxyContin for all types of pain.
So in your reports, though, I mean, you've been following this for years, and so this might be familiar to some people who have kept up with your reporting, but I do just want to, again, go tick through the years here, because it's just what? Just a couple of months, 5 months after the FDA's approval, that Richard Sackler, the head of Purdue Pharma then, is sent a medical journal describing how drug abusers were extracting morphine from another related Purdue Pharma product?
Correct. You know, essentially the whole foundation of OxyContin's marketing campaign and the approval that it received from the FDA was the concept that people that abuse drugs like to get a quick hit. So they would like drugs that acted quickly, drugs like Vicodin or Percocet. And because drugs like OxyContin acted slowly, they'd be less interested in those drugs. So Purdue made both OxyContin and it made a drug called MS-Contin, which was a long-acting form of morphine. And it was slightly after the approval of OxyContin that Purdue began receiving information that, in fact, MS-Contin was being abused, that people who were drug abusers were being drawn to it.
Okay. So we have the advantage of your reporting in 2020 hindsight, but it is stunning to hear that just in a year later, in 1998, there's this report in a Canadian journal, right, from a doctor who is actually someone who was a paid speaker for Purdue Pharma, but he published an editorial in this Canadian journal saying that contrary to the FDA's beliefs or FDA's approval for OxyContin, that long-lasting opioids such as Oxy are actually coveted by drug abusers?
That's absolutely correct, yeah. And it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, essentially, on the one hand, you have a company, Purdue Pharma, going out and marketing this drug, telling doctors, telling patients that it's less prone to abuse. And while it is doing that, it is gathering what prosecutors found was a mountain of information that essentially all of that was untrue. It was basically a lie. So you have, you know, the fantasy that's being promoted by this company, and you have the reality, and they're two very different things. And the unfortunate effect is that, you know, this drug was prescribed at a time when people were abusing it and people were getting addicted to it.
So as you lay out in extraordinary detail in your reporting, again, there's 1998, this growing amount of evidence, as you're saying. In 1999, a Purdue sales rep says we've got a credibility problem with our product because there's more bad press around it. In that same year, the general counsel for Purdue, Howard Udell, says we have, in fact, picked up references to abuse of our opioid products on the internet. So, I mean, how much did they know, Purdue Pharma execs, before the year 2000?
According to prosecutors, and they're the ones who were able to go through millions of Purdue records and emails, they brought Purdue officials before a grand jury to testify, it was their conclusion that by 1998, so this is 3 years after OxyContin, or actually 2 years after OxyContin appeared on the market, they knew enough to basically blow the whistle, to call a timeout, to alert regulators, to alert lawmakers about what they were seeing, but they never did. And so basically you had this this catastrophe that didn't need to happen. If Purdue had acted conservatively and alerted regulators and doctors to what it was seeing.
Okay. But then in what, 2001, there is a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing where Purdue Pharma's Vice President of Research and Development, Dr. Paul Goldenheim, essentially says they didn't know any of this. That's what he testified to. And I just want to play some tape here that he says they didn't know anything until, what, 2000 or 2001. Here's Paul Goldenheim.
In February of 2000, we got a copy of a letter that then U.S. Attorney Jay McCloskey of Maine sent to physicians in Maine, warning them of problems of OxyContin that were occurring in certain communities. And I believe it was March of that year when that was published in the Bangor Times. That was the first time we had any inclination that something different was going on that required special attention.
So that's Purdue Pharma's Vice President, Dr. Paul Goldenheim, testifying in the House in 2001, saying they didn't know anything until 2000. But Barry, you and I just went through several dates that show that they knew stuff as far back as 1996, 97.
Correct. And what federal prosecutors wanted to do, the people who had actually investigated this case, was to indict Dr. Goldenheim and to indict the general counsel of Purdue and indict the chief executive of Purdue, because they believed that those statements were not true, that there was, in fact, a lot of evidence to show that the top officials of Purdue knew that the drug was being abused, and they concealed that information, or they participated in a conspiracy to conceal that information.
Well, I mean, there are so many stunning details in your reporting, Barry. You note here that in the year 2000, there was a vice president of marketing who wrote in an email to other Purdue Pharma execs that some pharmacies would not even stock MS-Contin, the other drug, for fear that they'd be robbed, and that in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, they had physicians indicted for prescribing too much. And another Purdue Pharma exec responds, do you want all this chat on email? So knowing it's knowing that it was even problematic that they were discussing it with each other.
Let me put it in the simplest possible terms. I covered this story for 17 years. I wrote a lot of stories for the Times about it. I wrote a book about it. It was about a year and a half ago that I got this report. And I can only describe my reaction as one stunned by how much prosecutors had found out about this company, what they knew about this company and its behavior, and also heartsickened by the fact that had this information come out when it should have come out, that it would have had a very powerful impact on the trajectory of the opioid epidemic. And, you know, we wouldn't be dealing with the scope of the epidemic that we are today had this information come out a decade ago.
I mean, that's a sobering thing to say, Barry, because you know Purdue Pharma. I mean, they responded to you in a statement. They sent us the exact same statement. To this day, they claim that to, you know, put that kind of responsibility on Purdue Pharma for what they call, you know, a multifaceted, complex epidemic isn't right, that you can't uniquely blame them for this.
I don't think anyone is uniquely blaming them. But I will say this, during all the time that I've covered this story, Purdue Pharma has tried to minimize its role in it. It did it from the very beginning. But the fact of the matter is that for years and years, this company betrayed doctors. It lied to doctors. It lied to patients. So whatever responsibility comes with that, and this is stuff that they've admitted, it rests on their shoulders. That's the responsibility that they bear.
Mm. So, again, at the crux of your recent reporting here is a previously unknown Department of Justice report that some federal prosecutors wanted to press very serious criminal charges against at least three of the top execs at Purdue Pharma. I mean, they had been investigating Purdue for, what, 4 years, since roughly 2001, 2002, right?
That's absolutely correct. This investigation began in late 2002. It went for 4 years. During the course of the investigation, they went through millions of Purdue documents. They interviewed Purdue officials. And at the end of the investigation, they came to a very simple conclusion. And that conclusion was that this company knew that that OxyContin was being abused. There was significant evidence of it. And they believed that the corporate executives of the company should be held to account for that.
Personal account, right?
That's absolutely correct. They should be charged as individuals with a series of serious felony crimes.
Right. I mean, that's the stunning thing about it. I keep using this word over and over again, but I can't help it because I think for a solid decade, we have heard a collection of voices out there asking, why has no pharmaceutical company executive been personally charged with crimes that or personally charged with allegations that could have led to a jail sentence? And yet here we find out the DOJ came awfully close to that. What happened? Why were those charges never filed?
There's a journalist named Jesse Eisinger who wrote a book called The Chicken Club. It came out last year and it was basically about the unwillingness or inability of the Justice Department to charge corporate executives with serious crimes. Look, if it was me or you or any of your listeners today, we probably would be in prison by now. We would have been charged with these crimes. But there is a type of back scratching that goes on between top Justice Department officials and big name corporate defense lawyers because, you know, 5 years from now, that Justice Department official is going to be on the other side of the table. He's going to be arguing to defend a corporate executive. And so you had people like Rudolph Giuliani and Mary Jo White, very high-profile former federal prosecutors who went in to argue this case or who represented Purdue or advised Purdue or its executives. And these top executives just folded, the top officials of the Justice Department.
So what you're saying... Well, let me back up here for a second and just note to listeners that we do realize that this is a family show. So, Barry, I'm sorry about the title of that book. Just don't repeat it again. That's all right. We don't want the FCC to get on our case. But look, the intensity and importance and passion around this issue, sometimes things are going to slip here on the radio. Barry, what you're getting at is that lawyers from Purdue Pharma, including at that time Rudy Giuliani, who you're saying was representing them, met with the DOJ and said whatever they said. And all of a sudden, coming out of the other end of that meeting, the Department of Justice that the highest levels told the U.S. attorney in charge of this investigation, John L. Brownlee, that what, they wouldn't support his prosecution?
That's correct. So essentially what the document shows, the report that is in Painkiller and I wrote about in the Times, shows that the case prosecutors and John Brownlee, who is the U.S. attorney in charge of the case, forwarded the recommendations for indictments to Justice Department headquarters. I learned through reporting that mid-level officials within the Justice Department supported these indictments. But it was only when a meeting took place between Purdue's defense team and the top officials of the Justice Department, people who were political appointees, that, you know, the outcome of that meeting was simply the message being sent to John Brownlee that they were not going to provide him with resources, with whatever he needed to move forward with this prosecution. So he was essentially left to twist in the wind.
So they ended up going for those misdemeanor charges, which Purdue settled on.
Correct.
For the $600 million fine.
Correct. I mean, essentially, he told someone who he spoke with shortly before this plea deal was struck that, you know, he didn't have the resources to take on Purdue. I mean, Purdue had unlimited financial and legal resources, and John Brownlee had this small, tiny team of prosecutors who had worked night and day to build this case, and they were just going to get steamrolled.
Well, so given all this that we know now, this afternoon I went back and watched some testimony that U.S. Attorney Brownlee gave before the Senate Judiciary Committee on July 31st, 2007. You know this testimony very well, I'm sure, because it was a hearing on the appropriateness of the misdemeanor charges and pleas regarding Purdue Pharma. And I just want to play some tape for listeners here, because it's remarkable to hear this, knowing what we know now. So first of all, here is U.S. Attorney John Brownlee's a moment from his opening testimony.
These convictions have confirmed what many believed for a long time, that Purdue's marketing of OxyContin was deceptive and criminal. It is important to note that most of the people never claimed that Purdue was solely responsible for their loved one's death. They just wanted Purdue to tell the truth about the drug. The investigators and prosecutors who built this case have brought that truth to light.
Did the whole truth come to light, though? I mean, not until now, right?
Yes. John Brownlee really worked hard on this case. His prosecutors killed themselves on this case. But he was essentially in a no-win situation. I mean, if you go forward in that tape, he is being pressed very hard by Senator Arlen Specter, a Democrat of Pennsylvania who's since died.
Well, we have two more pieces from that exchange. I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Okay.
And it's interesting because actually at this time, Arlen Specter was still a Republican because I think he moved over to the Democratic Party in 2009. But so I want to play this because you're exactly right. It is bracing. So I've got two little segments here. This is, again, the now late Senator Arlen Specter, who was then the Republican co-chair of the Judiciary Committee, really laying into Brownlee, saying, I mean, he doesn't really do this, but you can almost imagine him throwing up his hand saying it makes no sense if the government says that it had evidence of wrongdoing against execs at Purdue Pharma that it didn't pursue more serious criminal charges. Here's Specter.
There's a total disconnect. Either you have a basis for saying that there's an intent to mislead or you don't. And if you have a basis for saying there's an intent to mislead, it's because individuals acted in a way which led you to that conclusion. And that being so, I do not see how you can have a conclusion that the individuals weren't wrongdoers who deserve jail.
And so there's a lot of back and forth on that point, and Brownlee tries to explain his way out of that contradiction, but then Specter really pins him down.
Well, could you prove that any individual had the intent to mislead?
We did not charge any individuals with the intent to mislead.
I understand you didn't charge them. That wasn't my question.
Yes,
my question was, couldn't you prove that some individual had an intent to mislead?
The evidence in this case was reviewed by career prosecutors, investigators, and it was their judgment, and I agree with them, that under the evidence in this case, that the charging decisions, the felony for the company and the strict liability misdemeanors for the executives were the appropriate charging decisions.
Barry Meyer, what do you make of that?
Well, two things. One is that John Brownlee is, you know, trying to dance away from the obvious question. The second one is that John Brownlee was at that point trying to launch his own political career and was poised to run for Attorney General of Virginia. And the third part is that further on in the tape or in the transcript which I read, Specter tries to pin him down further and asks him about the evidence. And John Brownlee says, I can't discuss the evidence. Mm. It's basically covered by grand jury secrecy.
Right.
And what he is talking about is the evidence that is contained in the report, which I obtained and read and wrote about both in Painkiller and in The Times. And that is this extraordinarily damning evidence. And had he been able to speak of that evidence in 2007, it would have been explosive because there would have been no doubt that, you know, from his perspective, these weren't the appropriate charging decisions. In fact, the appropriate charging decisions that he wanted to make were felonies.
Hmm. Now, is this all happened, the misdemeanor plea and settlement came in 2007. And it's a painful isn't even the right word, tragic irony when you look at the growth of OxyContin sales and revenue and the number of prescriptions in the following years, right? I mean, I was seeing some numbers that showed between roughly 2007 to 2010, the sales of OxyContin rose from $1 to more than $3 billion. So I guess, are you headed down the road of saying that if more serious charges had been brought, we can't help but to wonder if there could have been an earlier curb to the vast availability of this very powerful prescription drug?
I don't think there's any question about it. And I don't think it's strictly limited to OxyContin. I think had the evidence that the government gathered been put on public display, regardless of who won this trial, regardless of whether the government won or the executives won, there would have been an awakening. There would have been a realization by doctors of how profoundly they had been deceived. They would have had far more information about opioids than they had. You know, it wasn't just the prescribing of OxyContin that continued to go up. It was all the other powerful narcotic drugs. And we would have been in a situation in 2007 where doctors probably would have started treating pain in other ways. So, you know, the unfortunate circumstances that continued to cascade from this decision were tragic. And in my view, they were avoidable.
Well, so once again, I just want to reiterate that Purdue Pharma sent us a statement, which I gather is probably similar to one they sent you, in which they say Purdue Pharma is committed to addressing the opioid crisis and we support a number of public health policies that are designed to stem the tide of opioid-related addiction and limit prescribing. And for more than 15 years, they say they've led industry efforts to help address prescription opioid abuse, which includes developing medications with abuse deterrent properties, et cetera. We recognize that more needs to be done, and we continue to pursue a range of solutions that will have meaningful impact to help address this national public health crisis. That's a statement, excerpts from a statement from Purdue. I mean, ultimately, Barry Meyer, you know, I remember in 2007, there were members of the federal government who said that a message was sent with that $600 million fine. So do you think, knowing what we know now, though, that is anyone in the government, we have some state-level cases against companies like Purdue Pharma, are people going to be examining all this closer once again? Do you think charges may ever be brought against executives individually?
Well, certainly there's the opportunity to bring charges against executives of other drug companies. I mean, these particular charges have been resolved where the Purdue executives mm-hmm. are concerned. But I think it's fundamentally important for the federal government to hold corporate executives to the same level of justice and scrutiny that a drug dealer on the street is held to the same level of scrutiny that you or I or any of your listeners would be held to. it is really time for special treatment of corporate executives to be over. You know, allowing them special treatment was a contributing factor to this horrible public health disaster that we are now confronting. And if we want to try to, you know, to solve it, that is one policy that has got to end.
Well, Barry Meyer is a former reporter with the New York Times. His recent reporting about what the Justice Department knew regarding what Purdue Pharma executives knew about the abuse potential of OxyContin. All that reporting in the Times is linked to our website, or we've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. And I also want to say that Barry's author of Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you, Barry. Thank you so very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Meghna. I greatly appreciate it.
Listeners, let us know what you think about all this. Send us a comment at radioboston.org or a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.